So, you know, we this is talk about, again, talk about the two-dimensional structures, and in particular some tilings and random tilings. Usually when we think about tilings, we think of sort of objects which are locally rigid. You have some tiles, you fit them together. But I want to talk about some flexible tilings, and flexible in a particular way. So the first part of the talk is going to be mostly on rectangle tilings, like this one. And then later on I will generalize to more interesting shapes. We have kind of a lot of information about rectangle tilings, and we know a lot less about the more general case. There's an interesting story which I, want to get across, and a lot of this is joint work with my co-author Aaron Abrams. At least the rectangular part. So here's a rectangle tiling, and as I said last time, this is you get such a tiling from a harmonic function on a planar network, like this one over here. There's one rectangle for each edge in the network, and if you just one thing we should notice is that a rectangle tiling of this type they come in families where you think of the moving the vertical and horizontal segments up and down, right? In this case, we have three vertical segments here, and I can think of this as being inside a fixed rectangle. So the three vertical segments x1, x2, and x3 can move in such a way, but they have to. I mean, in order to maintain the same combinatorics, I have some inequalities on the x's. So, right, the x2 has to be larger than x1, and x3 has to be larger than x1. Although the x2 and the x3 don't have any inequality relating the two. And similarly for the y's. So there's a certain, if you fix the boundary square or rectangle, then there's a certain polytope of tilings which have the same local combinatorics as this one. So that's what I mean by a linear family of tilings. And of course, as you vary these walls and ceilings, you can think about what's going on in terms of the resistor network over there, and remember that it's on the next slide. I've skipped a slide there, but there's some interpretation of the tiling as a harmonic function on a network where the aspect ratio of the rectangle is the conductance on the edge, and the heights are the voltages and so on. So everything, anytime you have some discussion about rectangle tilings of this type, you can think about what's going on the underlying resistor network. In particular, you're varying the conductances, but keeping the same combinatorics. So here is a much larger graph. I think it was a graph. This is just a sort of a sketch of what graph I took. I took a square grid, like a n by n. I forgot what n was here. Maybe like 50. You think about there's one vertex at the top where you plug in your battery at voltage 1 and voltage 0 is at the bottom, and I want to choose conductances so that the current always flows downhill in this direction. Sort of the every edge is directed downwards, and then again, there's a certain rectangle tiling associated to any choice of conductances which give this current, and you can so there's a big high-dimensional polytope associated, and rather than choosing sort of random conductances, IID conductances, you can just take a random point in this polytope, and it has some interesting limit-shaped structure. It's got a lot of you can see that it's non-homogeneous. It forms some sort of limit shape. there's some nice relation to random matrices going on in this picture. This is just a there's a lot of interesting probability that you can get from studying such a model. So this is sort of a motivation to study these types of rectangle tilings and see what we can say about them. All right. Somebody's calling me. Okay, so this is just a reminder of what we did last time, right? When you have a rectangle tiling, there's a network, and in particular, the as you well, one thing I wanted to point out is that once you know the tiling, then that determines an orientation of the current flow on every edge. Right, the flow from the purple to the green here is going, well, the flow between these two vertices is from the purple to the green because this purple has a higher potential than the green. But if I change the conductances around on this graph, I can arrange the conductances so that changes. So the direction of the current flow is not determined from the graph. It's a function of which conductances I use. In fact, this is what I discuss here. Now, as we change the conductances, the rectangle tiling can change in such a way that which coordinate is above which other coordinate will change. So the actual polytope which defines that set of rectangle tilings can actually change in an interesting way. Right, so this polytope is defined actually by the direction of the current flows in the network. For example, in this for this particular network, right, there's sort of two possible pictures you can draw, depending on the right here the upper vertex is the vertex I'm fixing the voltage to be 1. The lower vertex is voltage 0, but depending on the conductances, the current. The current on the central edge will either flow from left to right or right to left. The current on these two edges will always flow down because this is the source of current. This is the sink of the current. So those two edges will always be flowing down. But I have sort of two choices for the current along the middle, and those correspond to two different types of rectangle tilings. And each one has its own polytope of tilings associated to it. And one of the questions one might ask is, well, if I have a choice of currents, how do I decide what direction the current flows along that central edge? Yes, Lorenzo.
If you switch the orientation, wouldn't one of those diagrams upside down also work?
If you
take the left picture and you just turn it upside down, wouldn't that also work for the other orientation?
If I turn it upside down, you might just rotate it by 180 degrees?
You know, flip it.
Yeah.
Or rotate it by 180.
Oh yeah, that right. There are various symmetries here, but I mean, in a larger network, you won't have such a symmetry.
But that would give two fixed area rectangulations for each orientation. The one on the
No.
right and the one on the left turned upside down.
Oh well, I don't understand what you mean. Oh, you mean if I. If I change which vertex is 1 and which vertex is 0, is that what you mean? If I flip it upside down, then this vertex will have voltage 1, and that vertex will have voltage 0. Maybe I'm not understanding your question.
Yeah, but that's the same thing as taking the two things on the side and changing which one is higher than the other, which is what I thought you were doing.
That's what I'm doing here. Yes.
Right. So if you take the one on the left and you turn it upside down, that should give you the same topology as the one on the right, but they're different equal area, fixed area rectangulations.
The reason these are different is because there's actually two edges here. You see that little two there?
Okay,
I apologize for, I should have drawn in two edges, but I was too lazy. I just put a two there, meaning,
got
right?
It.
Okay. Generally, when you have a flow of current through a network, or a harmonic function on a network with one source and one sink. This is called a bipolar orientation of a graph. A bipolar orientation is an acyclic orientation of your graph with exactly one source and exactly one sink. So those are the orientations which arise from a harmonic function on the graph with two boundary components. And so the directions always form a bipolar orientation, and it turns out that for every bipolar orientation you get a different tiling, different polytope. And not only that, so we prove the following theorem that for every orientation you can actually adjust the area so that they're all equal. Or in fact, you can adjust the walls and ceilings so that you get any tuple of desired areas for the rectangles that you want. So here what I did was I found the unique tiling with rectangles of area 1 in the polytope corresponding to this bipolar orientation, and over here there's the unique tiling of area 1 in the polytope with that orientation. Right, so let me, maybe those slides are a little bit out of order at this point, but there's one fixed area rectangulation for each bipolar orientation of the graph. So your graph with two fixed points, one source and one sink, you look at the set of all acyclic orientations with that source and that sink, that's a finite set of orientations, and for each of those, you can find a rectangulation with all areas 1, or all areas whatever you want. And if you... it's kind of an interesting... one way... The equation which defines those fixed area rectangulations looks a lot like the harmonic function equation, except it's nonlinear. So the corresponding harmonic functions, which is the y values, which determine the solutions to this fixed area rectangulation problem, satisfy some equation which we call the inharmonic equation. It looks like the Laplacian equals 0 on all the internal vertices, except you use 1 over the difference in the voltage in the values f. So this is there's one equation for each vertex v. You sum over all the neighbors of v, 1 over f of v minus f of u, you want that to be equal to 0, and there's still the same boundary conditions at the sink and the source. And so you look at this nonlinear equation here, which, you know, it's just like the Laplacian equation, except I inverted this term here. And what you find is that there's not a unique solution anymore. There are many solutions, but the number of solutions is exactly the number of bipolar orientations of the graph. So, let's see. Here, I'll go back to that slide in a minute. Here's a more complicated example, just to show you that to illustrate that theorem. Right, here's a more complicated graph. It's got here's the source again. Here's the sink, and there's five internal vertices, and if you count the number of bipolar orientations, that is the number of ways the current can flow from the source to the sink, and still be acyclic, there happens to be 12. And for each of those orientations, you can find a tiling with rectangles, which arises as a Smith diagram for some set of conductances. And right, so here they are. Here's the 12 guys. I guess this particular orientation here, right, corresponds to this. Let's see, is it this one? Yeah, I think it's this tiling here. Right. So, for example, you know, the fact that this edge, the orientation is going that way, means that so this vertex is lying above that vertex. I should have labeled things better, but there's 12 possibilities. And you can find these 12 possibilities by solving some polynomial system of equations, some nonlinear equations. You have to find the roots of this algebraic system of equations. There happens to be 12 roots. All Let's go back. So now we can now let's discuss the here's sort of the big picture. We have a graph, and we can choose on each edge, we can choose a conductance, a positive real number. Right? So we have our space of conductances is, you know, R plus to the E, where E is the number of edges. And once we've choose the conductances, right, we hook up our battery, and we see that we get a certain current flow, and from that, once we have the current flow, each edge has a certain energy on it, dissipated energy, the Dirichlet energy along that edge, which corresponds in the tiling to the area of the rectangle. So there's a map from choices of conductances to energies on the edges. And if you choose positive conductances, the energies are going to be non-negative in general, but they're you might get unlucky and choose conductances where some certain edges have no current. Right? For example, if I choose these four conductances to all be equal to each other, then there's no current flowing across the central edge. So the energies are non-negative, but they could be zero. And this is a quite non-linear map. It's a rational map, but certainly non-linear, and it, in fact, it turns out that this map is m to 1 over the positive image here. So if you're looking for energies which are positive, strictly positive, then there is exactly then the pre-image always has the same size m, where m is the number of bipolar orientations of the graph, right? Which was 12 in the previous example. And there's another kind of mysterious fact about this map is that the Jacobian, the Jacobian of the map is 1 if you use logarithmic coordinates, so that it preserves the log-Lebesgue measure on conductances to energies. Now there's this intermediate space. Once I choose these conductances, I get the the conductances determine the orientation, and the orientation determines the tiling. And that tiling has, you know, the set of tilings is divided into pieces. Right? For each, let me see. the space of tilings is a union of polytopes, right? As I discussed earlier, let me start over. I choose conductances which have the property that all the orientations are non-zero, all the currents are non-zero, and so I get the actual orientation of the graph. Then I get over here an actual polytope, which is a set of rectangle tilings with the same combinatorics. And as I move around in the space of conductance, I get a union of polytopes which are joined along certain facets where some of the currents go to zero. And then for each of these polytopes, there's one polytope for each orientation. It's actually a homeomorphic. Each polytope is a homeomorphic onto this set of non-zero energies over here. So, and this homeomorphism, that was supposed to be illustrated here. If I fix the combinatorics of this, then I can move the walls and ceilings of these tiles in such a way to achieve any areas that I want, and the areas correspond to energies in the graph. Right, so when I write homeo in quotes, I mean that each polytope is homeomorphic onto these guys, but these this space here is a really union, essentially disjoint union of polytopes, one for each orientation. And the interesting thing is that this the Jacobian of this map is a certain Castellan matrix, is a Castellan matrix for an underlying graph. Does the picture make any sense? By the way, this kind of an interesting thing for you number theorists in the audience. When you solve this polynomial equation here, right, this is an equation defined over the rationals, and you solve it, you get the solutions are algebraic numbers, and the geometric quantities in this tiling, like the heights and widths, are algebraic numbers. Like this one, 1/36 times 19 plus √73. If I have an algebraic equation with defined over rationals, which has this as a root, it will also have another solution which has the Galois conjugate of that number, 19 minus √73/36 as a root. And so the Galois group of the algebraic numbers, the absolute Galois group, acts on the set of solutions, and it actually permutes the solutions. So, if you take this tiling here and you just apply the automorphism which sends √73 to minus √73, you will get exactly this tiling here. Yes?
When you look at preimages of not equal area, but of arbitrary energies, is it the same n-harmonic equation only with weights?
Yes. Oh, yeah, the weights go into the numerator here, right? Generally, the equation will be, energy divided by f of v minus f of u. Yeah. This is like when you're looking for a harmonic function, it minimizes the Dirichlet energy, which is this L2 norm of F, L2 norm of the gradient of F, the Dirichlet energy. That's how you solve for the harmonic function. And these n harmonic functions, you don't use the L2 norm, you actually maximize the L0 norm, which involves the sum of logs of gradient of F on the edges. So There is some way to find these things. You don't actually have to solve the equations to find the solutions. You can actually, there's some maximal principle some variational principle which allows you to find the solutions. And in fact, this is what I did here. Bipolar orientations are something which people have studied. The combinatorialists have studied for some time. And in fact, there's a very nice bijection between bipolar orientations of random planar graphs, I missed the word planar here, and a certain type of permutations called Baxter permutations. And so this allows us, it's easy to sort of generate random samples of random planar graphs with random bipolar orientations on them, a uniform random such object. And so what I did was I took a random sample of such a thing, and I just figured out what the constant area rectangulation looked like in a square. That's what it looks like. And I don't know if you can, what information this is supposed to convey, but I thought it was a pretty picture. So it's a way to embed the graph in the square, and a random planar graph in a square. And these people who work on quantum gravity have these random planar graphs, and they embed them in some conformal way. This is a sort of a highly non-conformal way to draw the graph. And I don't really know what any sort of scaling limit of this process is. But I think it's an interesting thing to study. Okay, so That's the story for rectangles. Turns out that there's the story when you deal with more arbitrary shapes is also interesting and has some more features. Right, so what I want to think about now is tilings, not with rectangles, but with convex polygons. And I'm going to start with a fixed tiling like this one and consider all tilings which are related to it by just moving the edges parallel to themselves, so not changing the slopes. Unlike the previous talk where we were thinking about all tilings with the same combinatorics, here I'm going to fix the combinatorics and the slopes. And again, you can see that, you know, as I move these black segments parallel to themselves, there's some polytope of tilings which are combinatorially equivalent to this one. Right? Now what we lose the electrical network interpretation, but I still want to explore this because there's still this underlying bipartite graph, and there's still the dimer model interpretation, which, you know, I didn't talk much about the dimer model last time, but it's sort of the motivation behind this whole project. So before we talk about tilings, let's just talk about a single polygon which has fixed slopes. The space of polygons with a fixed, where you fix the edge directions. This is something which Thurston studied briefly, and it turns out to be that it's a somewhat interesting model. So here's a polygon with slopes, you know, 0, infinity, and minus 1 when I go around. And here's another one, which is also a hexagon. Well, I want to consider generally not just polygons, but closed polygonal curves, right, with fixed slopes. So you know, horizontal, vertical, minus 1, horizontal, vertical, minus 1. Same thing here. If I go horizontal, vertical, minus 1, horizontal, vertical, minus 1. So these two are both hexagons in the same family. It's not hard to see that if you're given an n-gon, or more generally a closed polygonal curve with n edges, right, the space of closed polygonal curves with the same edge slopes in the same order is a linear space. It's just essentially a vector space of dimension n minus 2. You know, you have a set of n vectors which have arbitrary, so you fix the directions, but they have arbitrary lengths, which are real numbers. You think of a length as being positive, or you're allowing the length to be negative if you go in the opposite direction. And then there's two linear conditions for it to be closed, right? The x coordinate has to be 0 and the y coordinate has to be 0 when you come back. So that's it's just in fact a vector space of dimension n minus 2, R n minus 2. But if you're interested in the area, you can define the area on a closed curve by just integrating x dy around that closed curve, and the signed, that'll give you a signed area. And it's a quadratic form on that vector space. I don't know if this is really a theorem or it's just a fact. It's easy to prove. The signed area is a quadratic form of signature 1, comma n minus 3, which means it has one positive eigenvalue and n minus 3 negative eigenvalues. And If you're not a geometer, I don't know that you ever think about signature of a quadratic form, except to say a quadratic form is positive, definite, or not. But here's a case where it's actually interesting. It's a useful fact. I'll explain why it's useful in a second. But the proof is here's a proof by picture. If I want to compute the area of this convex polygon, what I can do is extend two of the sides, which are not adjacent but only differ by one side, until they meet. And so I add a little pink triangle there, and I can add a little pink triangle over here. And then the area of the white region here, the original polygon, can be written as the area of the big triangle minus the area of the two pink triangles. But the area of the big triangle, if you think about this polygon inside this family, which is parameterized by the edge lengths, then the area of the big triangle, the edge length of the big triangle is a linear function on this space. Right? It's just this, in fact, it's just this length plus this length, assuming that's a you know, isosceles right triangle there. So the area then is some constant times the length of the big triangle squared minus a constant times this length squared minus a constant times that length squared. So it's a square minus two other squares. So it has signature, you know, 1, 2 in this case. And this is a general fact. If you have a convex polygon, you always get a quadratic form of signature 1, n-3 if it has n sides. Does everybody believe that? Well, in particular, suppose that I fix the area to be 1, say. I'm interested in some fixed positive area. Then the space inside my space, my vector space here, there are two components, right? If I have a form, you know, x squared minus y squared minus z squared, and I set it equal to 1, then there's going to be two components of that space, right? If the tile is a triangle, then and I fix the area to be 1, and I fix this, remember the slopes are fixed, I can either draw the triangle sort of right side up or upside down, and those are the only two possibilities. Right, suppose I have a triangle, an isosceles right triangle, and I say the area is 1. You're going to draw me, and the slopes are 0, infinity, and 1. Then you're going to draw me two possibilities. Oops, that's not, I made a mistake. The other one is like this, right? If I tell you I've got a quadrilateral, if I've got a rectangle of area 1, with 4 sides, right? This is like x and y. Then again, you know, it can either look like this, or it can 1, 2, 3, 4. It can look like that, and where x times y is equal to 1. So there's a family sort of. These two components of the space are related by a 180-degree rotation. If you have a polygon up here, which has area 1, and you rotate it by 180 degrees, you'll get the polygon in the other component. On the other hand, you know, these two polygons are both, if you scale this one up, it'll have the same area as that guy, but it's not obvious if they're in the same component or not. Right? So just because there are two components doesn't mean it's obvious to figure out which component they're in. So Thurston actually proved more, and because he was interested in hyperbolic geometry, if we're still fixing a single polygon here, like a pentagon, if you fix the area to be 1, each component, right? Remember, there's this quadratic form. The area is a quadratic form on the space. So each component, when you restrict the quadratic form of signature 1, n-3 to a single component, you get a quadratic form restricts to a positive definite quadratic form on that component, and that component is actually isometric to the hyperbolic space of dimension n-3. So in particular, the space of area 1 polygons, closed polygonal curves, has this natural hyperbolic metric on it. And moreover, if you care only about convex polygons, right? Remember, inside the space of all closed polygonal curves with these edge directions, there is a special subset which consists of convex polygons. The set of convex polygons corresponds to an actual convex polytope inside this hyperbolic space. For example, if I start with a pentagon, then you know it's got 5 sides. Hn-3 is H2, so I have a copy of the two-dimensional hyperbolic space, and I can represent that in a Poincaré disk model, and the space of convex polygons is actually a polytope, in fact, a polygon, a closed polygon, inside HN minus 3. Turns out that if it's a regular pentagon here, then I will get a regular hyperbolic pentagon with right angles. The angles are always right angles, but as you change the slopes, the shape of this the parameter space here will get deformed. It'll still be a pentagon with right angles, but some of the sides will be longer. But if I keep changing these slopes, you know, at some point if this slope and that slope become parallel to each other, then one side of this thing will sort of go off to the boundary, and it'll become an ideal polygon. The parameter space will become an ideal polygon. Anyway, there's some interesting sort of hyperbolic geometry inside this. I mean, modeling this set of polygons, right? And another fun thing you could do is, if I have a convex polygon, I can make another polygon with the same area by extending two sides which differ just by a single side like this. If I add this little bow tie or butterfly, as it's called, then you know I've added a certain amount of positive area and I've removed the same amount of positive area. So I haven't changed the area, and I get a new point in the hyperbolic space, in the hyperbolic plane in this case, because it's a pentagon, and the space of these things, tilings of this type, will be another pentagon, which you get from this pentagon by just reflecting along the edge. So that's what I said here. Butterfly moves of this type correspond to isometries of the hyperbolic metric here, and they just correspond to reflection in the sides of the original fundamental domain. So you guys didn't know that you were going to do hyperbolic geometry today. What? Yes?
What do you mean by each component?
If I fix the area 1, right, inside this space of polygons with fixed edge slopes, if I restrict to signed area 1, there are two components to the space. Right, there's the upper component and the lower component, the yellow one or the blue one. All right, so now let's go back to tilings. Now we understand what's going on for a single tile as we move the edges in and out. Here's a tiling which has four tiles and it's got some particular areas, and there's another tiling which has the same slopes and the same areas, right? And what happened? What you can see is that one of these tiles got flipped over, right? The central tile changed orientation, and it's a fact. The theorem is that as long as the slopes are generic, which they're not really in this example, but there is exactly one tiling, and I have to tell you what generalized tiling is, for each choice of orientation and areas. So if I fix whatever areas I want, like I want all the areas to be 1, and I get to decide for each tile whether I want it to be in the upper component or the lower component, the blue component or the green or the yellow component, then I can solve these nonlinear equations, and I will find a generalized tiling, right? And so in this case, there are four tiles. There's going to be 16 different tilings, one for, you know. Unfortunately, most of them are not tilings in the sense that we enjoy, because they are in the wrong. They're not convex. They're still closed polygonal curves, but they don't make convex polygons anymore. So in this example, if we fix all the areas to be whatever they are, in this case, there are actually 16 tilings, 16 generalized tilings, And here are eight of them. The other eight are obtained by just rotating the whole slide upside down. Four of them form actual tilings, the two in the middle and two, the rotations. And then the others are obtained by, for each tile here, you know, like this tile, there's a corresponding tile here, but it's a non-convex polygon. It's, you know, been turned inside out in parts of it. I don't actually know at the moment, you know, how to count the number of actual solutions and how to throw out the spurious solutions, but it's still kind of an interesting fact that you're solving these polynomial equations. You always get exactly 2 to the n roots. They're all real roots, and they all correspond to these different tilings, right? And once you find one tiling, then at least if the areas are sufficiently generic, it seems like the polynomial is irreducible, and the Galois group will actually, you know, act transitively on the set of all solutions. Like if I apply a Galois automorphism to this tiling, it'll give me every other tiling in this set. I can't actually prove that. I just experimentally, that's true. All right. So some further consequences, and then I'll stop here. I think I'm running low on time. You start with your tiling like this one. For each choice of orientation, the set of possible areas which give you an actual tiling is always homeomorphic to a ball. This is like an analog of the theorem I talked about yesterday. If you look at this allowed areas, it always forms a topologically trivial set, a ball, copy of R n, where n is the number of tiles. And the proof uses this Castellane matrix, this underlying bipartite graph, right? If I suppose I start with this tiling and I try to increase the area of one tile like this one, I can do that by moving the walls parallel to themselves, and so there's a map which gives you the areas as a function of the intercepts of the walls, right? The map from intercepts to areas is a local homeomorphism because its derivative is actually the Castellane matrix, which I talked about yesterday for this underlying bipartite graph. You know, remember that the Castellane matrix is a adjacency matrix of this bipartite graph with white vertices and black vertices, and on each edge there's a weight, and the weight is the length of the included segment here. So if I move this edge, suppose I take this edge here, and I move it by epsilon in that direction, how much does the area of this thing increase? It increases by exactly epsilon times the length. And you know the area of this tile decreases by epsilon times the length of that segment. That's exactly saying that the derivative of this map is the Castellane matrix. So I think this is cool because the Castellane matrix is just this combinatorial thing, this adjacency matrix of this graph invented by Castellane to count dimer covers. Here it's actually, you see it as an actually geometric object. It's the Jacobian of a certain, I mean, it's the differential of a certain geometric mapping. All right, so one more slide here. So here you can now try to think probabilistically about these models. So what I did was I took a tiling, and I took a tile. It's the one which is slightly bigger than the others, and if I increase its area, fixing the areas of the others. So what I did is I think of this as being in a box where the top left and the bottom side are fixed, but the right side is like a piston. It's free to increase. So when I increase the area of that one tile, all the tiles move, and you know more stuff pumping air into that cavity. But what you're supposed to notice is that all the walls of that moving tile are moving outward, right? Even the wall on the left is moving to the left. The wall on the left is moving to the left. The upward wall is moving up. The rightward wall is moving to the right. And this follows because the probability of an edge in the Dimer model is a positive number. So that inequality that says when I increase the area of any tile, all of its walls move outward, away from that tile, that follows from the fact that the edge probability in the underlying Dimer model is a positive number. In fact, the speed at which it moves is the probability that edge appears. Okay, so here's my conclusion. I talked about rectangulations, and in that case, the set of polytopes which arose in those tilings corresponded to bipolar orientations of a network, and in the generic slope case, the polytopes corresponded to all orientations. There was like 2 to the n orientations here, rectangulations, of course, do not have generic slopes. Many of the slopes are parallel to each other. In fact, every slope is either horizontal or vertical. And so there's got to be some intermediate case here, which I don't know how to count. I mean, there's some combinatorial interpretation of the set of polytopes in some intermediate cases, which I don't know. And I think that's an open question for combinatorics, not so much probability at the moment. So I will stop. Thank you.
Questions?
Lorenzo.
Sorry.
No, that's fine.
The business about the signature being 1 n minus 3,
yeah,
that requires that the original directions have to correspond to a convex polytope.
That's correct.
So, if you had something that's non-convex, you could get a different signature, in which case, instead of being in a hyperbolic space, you'd be in some other homogeneous space.
Yes.
Have you played with that game?
I have not. But certainly that's something worth exploring. Which I don't know. I don't know what you would say there. But yeah, sure.
Nick. So do you think there's some weird kind of electricity that corresponds to these triangular tilings that maybe exists out there in another universe?
Well, I've been working on dimers for nearly 20 years, and there's a relationship between dimers and electrical networks, resistor networks, but for me, dimers have their own electricity. So you can interpret all these geometric quantities in terms of the dimer model, which is also a linear model, where it's a determinantal process, very similar to the electrical network model, but different. So my answer is that yes, there is an interpretation, but it's a sort of dimerian interpretation. Tut actually made some attempt to do this for, he was aware of this rectangle tiling, and he tried to do it for, equilateral triangles and so on, and he invented this concept of leaky electricity. But I think the right interpretation is this dimer interpretation.